groups has gone into effect following the recent relentless Israeli strikes on the besieged Gaza Strip that killed more than 240 Palestinians, including 65 children. 12 Israelis were killed in retaliatory attacks by Palestinian resistance groups in what has been described as a game changer in the political and military equations of the region. Palestinians have hailed this ceasefire as a major victory for the resistance and all Palestinians. In this edition of the debate, among other issues, we'll look at what Israel and the Palestinian resistance achieved from this conflict.
A ceasefire took hold on Friday in the Gaza Strip as Israel and Hamas agreed to halt nearly 2 weeks of fighting that left hundreds dead and parts of the impoverished Gaza Strip destroyed. There were no reports of violations early Friday, though each side said it stood ready to retaliate for any attacks by the other.
After the ceasefire, I am sending words of thanks and appreciation for the Palestinian resistance and for the countries who supported Palestinians with both money and weapons, especially the Islamic Republic of Iran that offered everything and stood with Palestinians to a great extent.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip took to the streets and held celebrations of their victory, embracing one another in front of bombed buildings. Palestinians in Gaza could not mark Eid al-Fitr festival at Ramadan conclusion due to the Israeli airstrikes. On Friday, postponed Eid celebrations were held throughout Gaza.
This is a celebration of our victory. We celebrate winning and teaching the inhumane Israeli regime a lesson that we won't remain silent over its crimes, even if it costs us everything, even our children and homes. This is the road of our resistance till Palestine is free.
We spent days of Ramadan waiting for aid and then this escalation started, but we all supported Al-Aqsa and Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem. Gazans did all of this to support Palestinians in Jerusalem. We didn't count on any other country. We supported each other and defended Al-Aqsa.
More than 10 days of attacks killed at least 240 Palestinians in Gaza, including 66 children, wounded more than 1,900, and damaged critical infrastructure and thousands of homes, according to officials. The clashes began when the Israeli regime attacked worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque and started its eviction plans of Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem.
We are all here now in high spirits. We have witnessed three wars, and today Gaza didn't give up defending Palestinians. We are glad of this victory, and we appreciate the efforts of our resistance that did everything to support us and defend our rights.
After days of Israeli strikes, people are here celebrating their victory, stressing to support the Palestinian resistance in the face of the Israeli violations of Palestinian rights. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Joining us on this debate, we have Middle East affairs expert Karim Sharara joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mr. Sharara, welcome to the program. The reactions are pouring in today. The ceasefire is being celebrated as a victory for Palestinian resistance groups against the Israeli regime. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, has also congratulated the Palestinians for this triumph, and he said the Israeli regime is growing weaker by the day. Talk to us more about the leader's views and also how significant this triumph has been.
Well, first starting off with the leader's views, I think that he highlighted three main points that I think would summarize the entire scene for us and its developments. First of all, the fact that we now have a unified, not just a unified Palestinian intifada, but also a unified Palestinian resistance. This had not happened before. The Palestinian resistance had not coordinated to such an extent. But so for the first time, we have a unified operations room wherein the Palestinian resistance can coordinate its efforts in order to better tackle the Israelis. As for the Intifada, we have never seen such momentum, such bravery on part of the Palestinian people. And this has been something that's been growing for a number of years because the Israelis have been growing even more and more bold, evicting people from their homes, killing people outright, basically making Palestinians feel even less and less secure. Well, when you get to such a level of security, such a low level of security, the Palestinians have nothing to lose at that moment. So this is the significance of what we've seen today. As for the second point, he also spoke of he also said how the timing of the attacks and the retaliation is now in the hands of the Palestinian resistance. This is also a novel development, because we had always seen that the resistance would fire and we'd wait for the Israeli retaliation so that we'd be able to gauge how things are going. But for the first time, the Palestinian resistance was the one setting the entire agenda of the war. I mean, things reached to a point where they were imposing curfews on the Israelis for all intents and purposes. So the Israeli was as weak and as fragile, the Israeli side was as weak and as fragile as it's ever been. As for the third point, and this was related to the region and the Islamic world, wherein he said that it's a duty, but a religious duty to the Islamic that the Islamic world support the Palestinian resistance, and I think that this is more of a wink at Arab and Islamic countries that are going towards a road of support, not just support, but normalization with the Israelis. Look, the Americans are on a downward spiral because they can't. They won't be able to go head to head with both the Russians and the Chinese. They're in a losing war. They're in a losing battle. The Israelis are also losing support on a day by day basis. They're growing weaker on a day by day basis. And then you have these regimes completely going against the wills of their people, choosing to ally themselves with the Israelis. Look, this is our house. This is our home. The Israelis are on a downward spiral. They're effectively being they're effectively dissolving from the inside. And you always know that the house always wins.
Okay, stay
so
with us, Mr.
You should bet on the house and not on the other side.
Stay with us now. Journalist and political commentator Julia Qassem is joining us on the line now from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Ms. Qassem, welcome to the program. Hamas's Ismail Haniyeh called this ceasefire victory for all Palestinians, highlighting the much-lauded Palestinian unity in the face of the recent Israeli aggression. Our correspondent in Gaza said it many times that this is the most united Palestinians have been in recent times. How important is it to see this level of Palestinian unity?
As you mentioned, that all Palestinian resistance factions, as well as Palestinians, the popular, the people across the West Bank and Gaza are united and have been united in this campaign of resistance. Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hamas, Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine have all been coordinating excellently and working together in coordinating strikes that have hit major military and production facilities and targets across the occupying entity. And this has actually forced Israel to take a ceasefire. The resistance didn't want or didn't ask for a ceasefire. A few days ago, Palestinian Islamic Jihad leader Ziad Nahali said that he doesn't want a ceasefire until the liberation of Jerusalem is at least a guarantee. But, of course, we can see that Israel's decision to go into a ceasefire is a admission of defeat from its part, that it cannot even compete with the Palestinian resistance has been operating out of Gaza throughout this 11-day campaign. So we see that the Palestinian resistance has been more united and more coordinated than ever, and at the same time, it's been stronger than ever. It barely even exhausted its old stockpiles that it was using to bring the Zionist entity to its knees and to the point of a ceasefire, let alone what could have happened if the Gazan resistance had brought in its allies regionally. to confront the Zionists alongside it, or to really bring out the newer, heavier-grade weaponry. Now, this is why it's considered a victory from the Palestinian end, not because this is a total endpoint and this is the ultimate objective. The ultimate objective is the liberation of Palestine, but this represents an incremental victory that is further pushing the Zionist entity and its objectives back, which it has not been able to achieve since 11 days.
Mr. Sharara, looking at the intensified Palestinian rocket attacks against Israeli targets, do you think the retaliation, it change the overall dynamics of the situation if the Israelis are now more concerned for their security?
Well, look, if you look at the developments on the internal front, you'll see that the resistance has been able to target critical Israeli infrastructure, critical Israeli facilities. So yes, of course, the Israelis are growing even more worried because not only has the resistance been able to reach these new targets all around Israel, all around the occupied territories, but they still have more things up their sleeve, and the Israelis can only suspect as to what these development or what these capabilities may be. I think what concerns the Israelis, of course, they're concerned. They have this concern, and it's a very urgent concern. But the major development that occurred in this war was the fact that the unrest is no longer limited to the Gaza front, but has spread all throughout the occupied territories. So, I mean, and I think this rings true with what the leader said a few years back on the need to arm the West Bank, because what we've seen from this round of war was an activation or a new development on that front. The Israelis are more concerned on their internal front. Because, look, the major selling point that Israel had throughout these years was their Iron Dome and their the fact that they've been able to control their internal security so well for these years. And this myth, for all intents and purposes, has crumbled in this war. So they can no longer guarantee their security on the domestic level. So how long will the Israelis be? I mean, how can you counter an angry populace? How can you counter entire regions of people willing to stand up to you and your supposed citizens and your settlements, willing to die because they no longer have security? If you can't do anything about it, if you can't guarantee your citizen security. So right. When that myth crumbles, you're going to see droves of people flying out of Israel or escaping Israel, escaping the occupied territories, because this regime can no longer do anything to secure their presence.
Julie Qassem, Hamas's Ismail Haniyeh thanked Iran for their financial and arms support. To what extent can support from countries like Iran boost the resistance against the Israeli attacks and aggression? All right, I believe we've lost that connection. Let's address that question to Mr. Sharara. Karim, please give us your response to that question. I'll just repeat it again. Ismail Haniyeh thanked Iran in particular for their financial and arms support. To what extent, in your opinion, can support from countries like Iran boost the resistance in the face of the Israeli attacks and aggression?
Okay, so one of the main things about Iran's support is, first of all, it's not conditional. It's as if you would support an ally that you fully entrust with the ability to manage their own front. Why I'm saying this is because the Americans wouldn't do the same thing for the Saudis. The Americans, first of all, see the Saudis as a consumer economy, and this is a market for them. so where they can sell their weapons and at the same time guarantee their own presence in the region. That's not the way Iran looks at Palestinian resistance movements in general. The way Iran deals with things is, we're prepared to supply you with whatever you need to not only to survive but to emerge victorious. And not only that, we're also prepared to give you the know-how so that you can develop these weapons on your own. And this is what Hamas leaders have always stated, that not only has Iran been supportive of us, either financially or logistically, but they have also given us the know-how so that we can create these missiles on our own. And this is something that we've seen in Yemen, for example, although Iran is not involved in Yemen, but the Yemenis are manufacturing these missiles on their own. So to answer your questions, Iran is not only at the backbone of the resistance in the region, it's also given resistance movements such a great margin in their own autonomy that they know how to deal with matters themselves. They know what weapons to manufacture. They know what to do. And without the support of Iran, we wouldn't have gotten to where we are today. I mean, if it wasn't for Iran and its support for Hezbollah, we wouldn't have had a liberated southern Lebanon. If it wasn't for Iran's support of Hezbollah, we wouldn't have had Hezbollah pose such a great threat to the Israeli regime that they're more concerned about Hezbollah than they are about Gaza. If it wasn't for Iran's support for Hezbollah, then you wouldn't have had a transfer of experience or a sharing of experience among different resistance movements in the entire region.
Right. Karim Sharara, Hamas has called on the international community to help rebuild Gaza. This is a very important question, a main question personally for myself as well. Does the international community want to help in rebuilding Gaza? If so, why is it not happening?
Well, it depends what you mean by the international community. If by international community you mean the major powers, the G7, countries in the Security Council, well, this isn't going to happen because it's not in their interest to support, to rebuild Gaza and strengthen it against the Israelis. I mean, they want the Gazans shattered. They want the Gazans demoralized. They want Gazans to see death all around them. And they want Gazans to die, basically. If by international community you mean the people of the world, not their governments, well, then you would have a totally different answer, because the scene that we've seen over the developments that we've seen over the years, especially in this year, where it's so clear to everyone that the Israelis were the aggressors and they had no international cover or no moral cover, no ethical cover whatsoever. I mean, they never did, but it was so clear this time. I think that in the near future, not yet anyway, we may see campaigns of people, of droves of people heading towards Gaza to help with rebuilding it. You may have you may have individual people partaking in fundraisers. You may have groups of people just going to share expertise. You may have a number of volunteer organizations going to rebuild Gaza. But do we expect anything on the international scene? I mean, unless it's a country that's deeply invested in resistance, and we know for sure that the Israelis will be unable to do anything about it, then we're not going to see anything of the sort. They want Gazans to die. They want the Palestinians to die. They want the Israelis to survive. They want the Israelis to rain death upon us all. Of course, this isn't going to happen, but, I mean, they have their own right to wishful thinking. That's not going to happen.
All right, let's end it on that note. Middle East affairs expert Karim Sharara joining us. From the Lebanese capital, Beirut, also thanks to journalist and political commentator Julia Hassem speaking to us on the line from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, as well. Also, special thanks to her for staying with us on this debate. It's a good night for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. And we brought forth for you thereby gardens of palm trees and grapevines, in which for you are abundant fruits and from which you eat.
The 19th verse, dear listeners, starts saying, فَأَنْشَأْنَا لَكُمْ بِهِ جَنَّاتٍ مِّن نَخِيلٍ وَأَعْنَابٍ. Then we produced for you therewith gardens of date palms and grapes. لَكُمْ فِيهَا فَوَاكِهُ كَثِيرًا. Wherein is much fruit for you. وَمِنْهَا تَأْكُلُونَ. Whereof you eat. So, as you have been previously with us, after mentioning the rain, this abundant blessing, the Holy Quran continues by enumerating the results of that rainfall in this noble verse. فَأَنْشَأْنَا لَكُمْ بِهِ جَنَّاتٍ مِّن نَخِيلٍ وَأَعْنَابٍ. Then we produced for you therewith gardens of date palms and grapes. So we all know that dates and grapes are not the only products of cultivation, because there are many other fruits and plants cultivated in the gardens, but they are from among the most valuable of them. Plants and trees are created for human use. Among the fruits, some of them, like the date and the grape, are special. The wise Allah, by providing us with fruits from the soil, has supplied man with his material needs. Interestingly, this could be one of the other secrets beyond the previous verse, where it says, فَأَسْكَنَّهُ فِي الْأَرْضِ. We launched water in the earth. One of the reasons we can have gardens of date palms and grapes and other fruits is because of the storage of water we have within our reach. The Quranic sentence, وَمِنْهَا تَأْكُلُونَ, in this verse, and whereof you eat, probably indicates that the products of these gardens include fruits that are both edible as part of it and other things that are inedible.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insight into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Dear listeners, one reason that palm gardens are mentioned in this verse is that some plants, like palm gardens, have often manifold uses for human life. Their leaves are used to make carpets, sometimes they are used to make garments. They are used for forage. Their wood is used to build houses. That wood is sometimes used for making fuel out of. The leaves, the fruits, and the roots of some of the trees are also used to make medicines. Fakhr Razi has said in his commentary that the probable purpose of the sentence "minha ta'kulun" is that our lives and our provisions are determined by those gardens. Just as we say that such and such person lives by doing such and such a job. It is also worth mentioning that in this verse, the origin of man's life is the sperm drop, and the origin of plant life is rain. In fact, these two distinguished examples of life are both originated from water. Allah's law is one and covers all things. Water is the very basic element for life, be it for human beings or other gardens and plants. That this very small drop of water is used for human beings. All gardens and trees are made for the use of human beings. The word lakum is used in this verse, and sha'na lakum, for you. We created all these things for you to use, and we even provided you sustenance, نخيل وأعناب, and even more than you already need, فواكه كثيرة, منها تأكلون. You eat some of them, but you could use some other for different purposes. And what proves that this kind of understanding from the verse might be true is the 20th verse of this chapter, which we will inshallah get to talk about in the next program.
Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the world with reporters.
A ceasefire took hold on Friday in the Gaza Strip as Israel and Hamas agreed to halt nearly 2 weeks of fighting that left hundreds dead and parts of the impoverished Gaza Strip destroyed. There were no reports of violations early Friday, though each side said it stood ready to retaliate for any attacks by the other.
After the ceasefire, I am sending words of thanks and appreciation for the Palestinian resistance and for the countries who supported Palestinians with both money and weapons, especially the Islamic Republic of Iran that offered everything and stood with Palestinians to a great extent.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip took to the streets and held celebrations of their victory, embracing one another in front of bombed buildings. Palestinians in Gaza could not mark Eid al-Fitr festival at Ramadan conclusion due to the Israeli airstrikes. On Friday, postponed Eid celebrations were held throughout Gaza.
This is a celebration of our victory. We celebrate winning and teaching the inhumane Israeli regime a lesson that we won't remain silent over its crimes, even if it costs us everything, even our children and homes. This is the road of our resistance till Palestine is free.
We spent days of Ramadan waiting for aid and then this escalation started, but we all supported Al-Aqsa and Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem. Gazans did all of this to support Palestinians in Jerusalem. We didn't count on any other country. We supported each other and defended Al-Aqsa.
More than 10 days of attacks killed at least 240 Palestinians in Gaza, including 66 children, wounded more than 1,900, and damaged critical infrastructure and thousands of homes, according to officials. The clashes began when the Israeli regime attacked worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque and started its eviction plans of Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem.
We are all here now in high spirits. We have witnessed three wars, and today Gaza didn't give up defending Palestinians. We are glad of this victory, and we appreciate the efforts of our resistance that did everything to support us and defend our rights.
After days of Israeli strikes, people are here celebrating their victory, stressing to support the Palestinian resistance in the face of the Israeli violations of Palestinian rights. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
In Lebanon, support for Palestine has overcome even internal crises, with more people rallying to show support. The Palestinian Resistance Hamas representative in Lebanon told Press TV, Palestinian Resistance has the advanced capabilities to deter the Israeli aggression for an unrestricted period of time.
We have reached a new phase in the conflict with the Zionist enemy, since the enemy is in a state of crisis, facing the blows of the resistance. The resistance in Palestine is part of the entire resistance front. The enemy has realized that if it launches an assault on any group, the entire front will come forward to give a due response. For now, the Palestinian resistance has declared that it has the capabilities to face this occupation for a long period of time with hundreds or even thousands of rockets.
A Hezbollah member of parliament at the rally said it is an Islamic duty for all Muslims, as it is for Palestinians, to liberate Palestine.
The Palestinian cause is not only for Arabs, it's also for all Muslims. When a nation is involved in a conflict, all other nations step into the fray to stand against the joint enemy. Our slogan is that Al-Quds victory is closer today more than ever.
Despite the heinous Israeli crimes, Palestinian people's intense uprising and resistance remain unabated. Observers believe that that in itself will weaken the Israeli army.
We cannot describe with words the heroic endeavor of the Palestinian people. We can only salute the great Palestinians and their martyrs. We also salute all those who have stood with them in the most difficult circumstances. A salute to the Islamic Republic of Iran, since it weren't for Iran, the entire region would have a different fate. The 2006 war in Lebanon destroyed the first pillar of the occupation regime, and today in Palestine, the second pillar has already fallen.
Hundreds of Lebanese and Palestinians are holding protests on a daily basis across the country to show that they are ready to give more direct assistance to Palestine if need be.
We are ready to put all our efforts in assisting the oppressed people in Palestine, and that is our duty to give that assistance for the sake of righteousness against our unjust enemy.
The Palestinian-Israeli conflict has always been inseparable from the Lebanese-Israeli conflict. Today, even Lebanese activists in solidarity with Palestine's uprising in the face of Israeli aggression say the Lebanese resistance should give direct backing to the Palestinian resistance whenever there is a need, anytime in the future. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A fourth round of talks to revive the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, concludes in Vienna, with delegations headed back home for further consultations. EU coordinator Enrico Mora said there'd been substantial progress in the past 10 days, but there were still issues that needed to be worked on. Mora said he believed an agreement was possible before Iran's presidential elections next month.
I will not venture a date because you never know, but I'm quite sure that there will be a final agreement, yeah, not far from here.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said the issues that needed resolution were difficult.
Some delegations believe that the next round could be the last round. I cannot say that definitely, but because we are not there, we are still not there. But I think that if the other side, especially the U.S. side, can make their difficult decisions, we might be able to come to the conclusion next time we meet here in Vienna.
Araghchi said Iran is standing firm on its position that the U.S. needs to fully lift all sanctions in a verifiable manner before Tehran can take action to come back to full compliance with the JCPOA. Reports indicate that though the U.S. has agreed to ease sanctions on various sectors like energy, banking, shipping and insurance, there are still differences on sanctioned individuals and entities, including Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. Questions have also been lingering on the fate of Iran's advanced centrifuges and whether the U.S. sanctions will be fully removed or temporarily eased. The sides have decided to meet again next week. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
These protesters have staged a sit-in in Imam Hussein Square of Tehran to show anger at the brutalities of the Israeli regime in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank.
This year, due to the corona pandemic, we couldn't stage rallies on Quds International Day. So today we are here to support Palestinians and condemn the atrocities of the Zionist regime against them.
Whenever a crime happens in the world, the international bodies release statements and slam it. But they are silent about the brutal acts of Israel in Gaza. I'm here to show solidarity with Palestinians and tell them that they are not alone.
It is our duty to participate in such events. Since the Islamic Revolution, we have participated in all these demonstrations, and right now we are here to support the innocent women and children of Gaza and Palestine.
Waving the flags of Palestine and the resistance movement, they chanted slogans against the global arrogance and the Israeli regime, which has recently begun a new wave of attacks on the besieged Gaza. In their slogans, the demonstrators also announced that they stand with Palestinians and their cause until they achieve victory. The IRGC commander was the speaker of the event, who blasted Israel, saying that this time the situation has changed.
This is the first time that Israel's shipping and aviation industries are disrupted. This is the first time that Israel's capital is being showered by missiles every day. This is the first time that all Zionists are in shelters.
At the end of this gathering, a statement was also read out to wrap up the demands of the Iranians from the international bodies regarding the crimes committed by Israel.
Over 200 people, including women and children, have been killed in recent Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip, while millions of people across the world have taken to the streets to condemn the Israeli aggression. The international bodies are still keeping quiet. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Palestinians have staged a nationwide general strike across the occupied West Bank and in historic Palestine, the lands occupied in 1948, to protest the ongoing Israeli bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip. The strike has led to the suspension of all economic activities and the closure of educational institutions across the occupied West Bank. Shops and private institutions in Palestinian areas in historic Palestine also closed down. Meanwhile, thousands of Palestinians took to the streets in Ramallah to support the strike.
We won't tolerate the continuation of the occupation. It must end. The Israeli regime carries out the ugliest practices against our people wherever they are, and then there are the settlers' ongoing violence, and now there are these airstrikes that are killing children and innocent people.
Protesters from all walks of life and of all ages participated in the rally that headed to the northern entrance of the city, where Israeli military checkpoint and illegal settlement of Beit El are located. The protesters held Palestinian flag and chanted anti-Israeli slogans in solidarity with the resistance in the Gaza Strip.
Today, we are rising against Israel's airstrikes on the Gaza Strip and its general operation against Palestinians here in the West Bank.
We are protesting against the ongoing violence against us, the Palestinians, and also to show support for the resistance in Gaza.
The rally, meanwhile, turned violent, with the Israeli soldiers at the checkpoint firing live ammunition. Palestinians in the occupied territories and historic Palestine have united with a general strike and a day of rage to send in numerous messages. On the top, an expression of anger against this barbaric aggression by the Israeli occupation. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
It was billed as an emergency meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers to discuss the deadly violence in the Middle East. In fact, critics of Israel call it an illegal and merciless bombardment of Palestinians rather than a conflict. The ministers couldn't decide on anything concrete, and so the 27-nation bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, ended up playing the event down.
In an informal meeting, there is no formal conclusions. And what I am going to explain you is my takeaway, my intellectual takeaway from the today meeting.
That takeaway basically consisted of merely calling for peace and for Israel's actions to be proportionate. Rights groups insist what's needed instead is for the EU to slap sanctions on Tel Aviv.
EU, especially if they are true and faithful to their own commitment for human rights protection, there is a time that they have to reflect on these issues. And I think also the pressure coming from civil society is playing a very important role.
But as Palestinians continue to suffer, perhaps Israel's influence in the West is too strong. The White House says the U.S. will continue to provide $3.8 billion in military aid to Israel each year, claiming the regime has a right to defend itself.
The United States cannot continue to act alone and try to impose on all of us, including the European Union, their ideas. They have to engage everyone as we engage in the United Nations.
A large number of EU lawmakers have issued statements condemning Israel's actions. Some of these statements have been strongly worded. They insist Israel is guilty of genocide and ethnic cleansing. The MEPs are calling on the EU to suspend its substantial trade with Israel until such time as Tel Aviv stops breaking international laws. EU legislators are due to hold a number of debates on the crisis this week. The big question is, what difference will they make when it comes to the powers that be? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has concluded his visit to Italy, where he held consultations on the enhancement of mutual cooperation and bilateral ties. On Monday, Iran's top diplomat met with his Italian counterpart, Luigi Di Maio, with whom he talked about political, economic and cultural aspects in view of the historical relations between Iran and Italy. This year marks the 160th anniversary of formal diplomatic relations between the two countries. Issues related to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the ongoing nuclear talks were also on the table.
Italy's position with regard to the nuclear deal is that of waiting to see what might happen. Rome doesn't have an autonomous policy of its own on a number of crucial international issues and is waiting for the US to make a move.
The talks between the two ministers revolved around Italy's posture on the nuclear deal. Years ago, under a Berlusconi government, Rome had the opportunity to play a leading role in the build-up process of the deal, but the role went to Germany in the end. Today, Tehran is assessing whether Italy aims to play a greater role in the revival of the JCPOA.
Also on Monday, Zarif met with the leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, who presented him with a gift that, the pontiff said, was a symbol of peace with an olive branch and a dove. The Vatican provided no comment on the content of the talks.
During his trip to Europe, the Iranian foreign minister was expected to visit Austria, where Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal are holding talks to find a way to revive the international accord. But the visit was cancelled after Vienna's decision to show solidarity with Israel by flying the regime's flag over government office buildings.
Italy has been quite careless on the Israeli-Palestinian crisis over the past years. Rome once held a position of equal closeness with the parts involved in the conflict, not one of equidistance like it is now. Italy was once very attentive to the needs of the Palestinians, whilst today its stance doesn't help finding a solution to the crisis for which Israel bears grave responsibilities.
On Tuesday, on his final day in Rome, Zarif met with a delegation of lawmakers from the Italian parliament at the Iranian ambassador's residence, Max Civili, Rome.
Free at last. Emerging from the gloom of a four-month COVID-19 lockdown, most Britons are now free to hug, albeit cautiously, visit their pub, sit down to an indoor meal, or visit the cinema. Freedom beckons once more. There is excitement.
I'm happy that I could go to the movies again, you know, because it's just been like you're running out of things to do.
We've just had a lovely lunch. First time putting all those months inside a restaurant. It felt good.
But beside the euphoria, there is also anxiety. The emergence of the Indian variant of COVID-19.
I'm told that if it's only marginally more transmissible, we can continue more or less as planned. But if the variant is significantly more transmissible, we're likely to face some hard choices.
Thank you very much. Everybody.
Perhaps the toughest of those choices, another lockdown. Some scientists, among them the government's chief medical officer, have warned of a summer surge in cases.
all the modeling suggests there is going to be a further surge, and that will find the people who either have not been vaccinated or where the vaccine's not worked.
So far, nearly 70% of Britons over the age of 18 have been offered their first dose of the vaccine, with the government saying the country is in a race between the vaccination program and the virus, especially the new variant first found in India that's been surging in several areas across England.
So will there be another lockdown? Boris Johnson has called the lockdown roadmap cautious but irreversible. Last month, he came under fire for allegedly saying, let the bodies pile on high in their thousands, after reluctantly approving a second England-wide lockdown late last year.
It'd be obviously disappointing, but I would say not entirely unexpected, to be honest.
Steps need to be taken to deal with it. And if that means additional vaccination surges in areas where it exists, or local lockdowns, or nationwide, or travel restrictions, then my belief is that those should be brought in.
The UK's official death toll is nearly 128,000, Europe's highest figure and the world's fifth largest, after the United States, Brazil, India, and Mexico. And the possible outbreak of the Indian variant is sure to upset the Johnson government's roadmap out of lockdown. Saeed Puriza, London.
The families of the victims of the recent deadly attack near a school in Kabul call for proper attention to be paid to those affected by the incident. The families put the casualties at 90 deaths and over 240 wounded, all students. They also called on the international community, the UN and human rights bodies to probe the brutal attack. Referring to repeated targeting of Shia people by terrorist groups in Afghanistan, they also urged the international bodies to officially confirm the systematic genocide of Shia people in the country.
The attack on Sayyid al-Shuhada School came after a series of targeted attacks on Shia religious sites, educational centers, and sports clubs. It's a genocide, and we want the government and international bodies to officially confirm Shia genocide in Afghanistan.
But as observers say, it seems that neither terrorist attacks nor political obstacles can push back the determined young generation of Afghanistan, as they are fully committed to go forward in order to build their own country by relying on knowledge instead of war and violence.
The government has not yet fulfilled its obligation to protect us. The recent attack on innocent schoolgirls was a big tragedy, and such incidents must be stopped in the future. The enemy must know that we will go forward despite the challenges.
It was in the afternoon of May 8 when three back-to-back blasts rocked western Kabul, and many fasting residents of the area witnessed how dozens of schoolgirls were hit by these blasts. Although the Taliban has denied any involvement in the attack, but none of other terrorist groups, including Daesh, has claimed responsibility too.
Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission has emphasized on the need for a practical step from the government. President Ghani has already ordered a thorough probe into the attack and has called on his government to work on a plan to boost the security in Kabul. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The limelight.
The Associated Press has fired a news associate, Emily Wilder, for violating the company's social media policies, a move that drew backlash from journalists after it became clear that Wilder had been targeted by right-wing media outlets for pro-Palestinian activism in college. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Manvi Singh. The piece is titled Outcry After Associated Press Journalist Fired Amid Row Over Pro-Palestinian Views. Stay with us for more of Manvi Singh's article. The The Associated Press has fired a news associate, Emily Wilder, for violating the company's social media policies, a move that drew backlash from journalists after it became clear that Emily Wilder had been targeted by right-wing media outlets for her pro-Palestinian activism in college. Emily Wilder confirmed to The Guardian that she was terminated for violating the company's social media policies in their news values and principles sometime between my start date on 3rd of May and yesterday. Wilder said the Associated Press did not detail which of her tweets broke its policies. A spokesperson for the Associated Press said that while the organization generally refrains from commenting on personnel matters, we can confirm Emily Wilder's comments on Thursday, 20th of May, that she was dismissed for violation of Associated Press's social media policy during her time at Associated Press. The spokesperson added that Associated Press's policy exists so that one person cannot create dangerous conditions for our journalists covering the story. Every Associated Press journalist is responsible for safeguarding our ability to report on this conflict or any other with fairness and credibility and cannot take sides in public forums. There's no question I was just cancelled, Emily Wilder told SF Gate on Thursday, 20th of May. She said her editor had previously told her she would not get in any trouble because everyone had opinions in college, but then came the rest of the week. Right-wing and conservative media outlets began publishing stories this week about Emily Wilder, who had previously worked with the newspaper Arizona Republic after graduating from Stanford University, when the Stanford College Republicans tweeted a thread highlighting her previous activism. The tweets included screen grabs of Wilder's previous Facebook posts in which she is critical of Zionists, including Sheldon Adelson, the late billionaire and Donald Trump's supporter. The threat took off. The right-wing Washington Free Beacon speculated that Wilder's hire in Phoenix could fuel concerns about the Associated Press's objectivity amid revelations that the news outlet shared an office building with Hamas intelligence in Gaza. The article was amplified by Tom Cotton, the far-right senator from Arkansas. Although the Israeli regime's military claimed that Hamas intelligence were operating in the building housing the Associated Press and Al Jazeera offices in the Gaza Strip, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said he had seen no evidence indicating that that was the case. Fox News Channel referred to Emily Wilder's hiring as a second Middle East-related issue for the Associated Press after the organization's offices were bombed in the Gaza Strip. Emily Wilder, who is Jewish, had tweeted 18 times since she began working at the Associated Press. Most were retweets. Her most subjective post was about objectivity on 16th of May. Objectivity feels fickle when the basic terms we use to report news implicitly stake a claim, she wrote, using Israel but never Palestine, or war but not siege and occupation. These are political choices, yet media make those exact choices all the time without being flagged as bias. The News Media Guild, the union that represents the Associated Press's editorial and technology staff members, said it was investigating Emily Wilder's firing by the Associated Press. The Guild asked if the comments that caused Emily Wilder's termination were posted before or after her hiring, and is awaiting a response from the Associated Press. Meanwhile, journalists responded to news of Wilder's firing with outrage and messages of solidarity. I stand with Emily, wrote Rebecca Sanders, an Arizona Republic reporter. Her reporting at our newspaper was excellent. Reverse your decision now. I'd bet a lot of money this person is about to get a much better job, tweeted NBC's Ben Collins. Several reporters drew contrasts between Emily Wilder's treatment and that of CNN's Chris Cuomo. Amid allegations that he advised his brother, the New York governor, Andrew Cuomo, on how to respond to sexual